My name's Noel.
Noel.
I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And,
Love you, Noel. Lots and lots and lots. And oh, bunches.
It's kind of sad when you're the guy speaker and you get to pull the microphone down. It's kind of... I wasn't being chivalrous when I asked her if she wanted to go first. I had to pee. And then I got back and I started drinking the water and now I got to pee again. So what do we got, a half an hour?
Yeah.
All right, so that'll be good because that'll be about my limit. It's kind of neat. There's a lot of people here in Maine. I got sober in Maine. A lot of times when I... Is there anybody here that's like only been sober for like a month or something like that? Anybody in the room? I mean, I figured probably most of those people... Yeah? Good, good. Congratulations, man. I just like to know, like, basically where people are at, because I, you know... when I get sober, I come into meetings and people would start talking about, you know, friggin' divorce and crisis and all kinds of... You know, I'm like, well, how do I not drink? You know, that's what I wanted to know. So usually when I go to, like, rehabs and stuff like that, I usually ask people, you know, is there anybody here who doesn't know how to drink? I mean, truthfully, I know how to drink. I'm pretty good at it. I could outdrink guys who are, like, three times my size. I remember when I was 16 years old, I was playing Anchorman with a bunch of guys from a wrestling team, and I was the Anchorman, and they quit. And, you know, so, like, I don't have any problem with drinking. The problem that I realize is not drinking. And I imagine that there's people in the room that have a little bit of problem with that, too. I when I get to AA, I didn't, and I still don't know. I don't have any idea on my own. I have absolutely no idea how to not drink. When I was 12 years old, I picked up alcohol, and I didn't put it down until I was 24. And I lived that entire period of my life pretty much drunk. Gradually, the number of days in between how long I went got fewer and fewer and fewer, and by the time I was ready to stop drinking, it was pretty much if I went a day, that was a big deal. And so I was 24 years old. I was living in Bangor, Maine. It's a really great place to drink. There's not really a lot else to do in Bangor, Maine. So I had gone up to graduate school, and I was going to graduate school, which is my first reason why I wasn't an alcoholic, because I was in graduate school, and you can't possibly be an alcoholic if you're in graduate school. And my other reason was because I had never done cocaine. And you put those two reasons together, and you've got a perfectly sound argument as to why you are not alcoholic. And so I was in graduate school, and they were paying for me to go to school. And I was a teaching assistant, and I used to, like, go study economics during the day. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd go out, and I'd look into the teaching assistant's room, and all the kids would turn around and look at me, and they were thinking these things about me. And they all thought that, you know, I was an idiot and I was a freak and I didn't belong there. And half of them thought I was gay. And then, the girls didn't really like me, but they should. And they all think they're smarter than me. So I couldn't stand what they were thinking, so I'd go home. And on my way home... I'd stop off in the Rite Aid. I loved Maine because I grew up in Massachusetts where you can't do anything. And in Maine, they sell beer at, like, gas stations and at, like, Rite Aids, which I didn't know what Rite Aid was until I moved to Maine either. But they sell beer at Rite Aid. And you walk into the Rite Aid, and I'm thinking, I got to eat dinner. I haven't eaten anything all day long. And I walk through the aisle and I go over to the beer aisle, and I pick up a 12-pack, and that's dinner. And then I bring it home, and I put it down on the counter, and I start making broccoli. And I'm going to have broccoli and beer. And you've got hops, barley, broccoli. I mean, it's like a full diet. And I threw a couple carbs in there, like some pasta, and I was good to go. And then I'd start studying economics, and I'm really friggin' good at economics. I don't understand why. It's just this weird thing that God gave me this gift. I'm really good at it. And so I'm studying economics, and I'm not an alcoholic because I can do statistics and I can do economics and drink a 12-pack of beer. And I call my friends up and tutor them on the phone and tell them about how smart I am, and then I get off the phone and think that they all hate me and think I'm too stupid to, you know. And it was insane. And what was going on was this kid lived upstairs from me. He was 18 years old, and I had gone to Maine because I got into like four other colleges for graduate school, but I was dating Beth, and Beth was going to be my wife, and she was going to have kids, and she was going to become a veterinarian, and I was going to be a school professor, and I was going to write books, and I could drink and stay home with the kids and write books, and she would be a veterinarian and really take care of me, and I'd go on sabbaticals, and I could go sleep with my graduate students, and all these things were going to happen. And it was just going to be fantastic. And so I'm in graduate school, and all the kids at school, you know, they think those things about me, so I can't talk to them, and I don't have any friends there. And Beth isn't starting to really not understand me anymore. And so I'm hanging out with the 18-year-old kid up above me, and I'm buying him beer at night. And then I come home from school at 3 o'clock because of what everyone's thinking, and I got to drink my beer and do my economics. And somebody stole my friggin' cigarettes. And I'm like, what happened to my cigarettes? Where'd they go? I locked the door before I left, and the cigarettes are gone, and then shit's getting moved all around my apartment. Someone's breaking into my friggin' house at night. And so then I'm like going into this panic, and everything's going crazy in my head, and it's like, and they're trying to trick me into like flunking me out of school, and things are going nuts. So then the cops start coming over to my house, but I can't tell the cops that it's the kid upstairs because I'm buying the kid booze. And I'm 21 years old, and I get a DUI, and if I get another arrest, then I have to go to jail, and da-da-da-da-da-da. So this craziness is going on, so I'm trying to talk to my girlfriend about it on the phone, and, she's in school, so she doesn't have time to hear this. And it's going absolutely insane. You know, I come home, things are missing, stuff's going crazy, everyone out at school's out to get me. And they're breaking into my house, they're stealing my cigarettes, they're moving shit around. Finally, somebody steals my grandfather's watch, and this is the one thing I actually cared about. It was a gold watch. It was the only thing I had that was my grandfather's. And so the cops were coming, and I said, you know, that's it. And I filled them in on what was going on. I was going to take my big chance that they don't tell the cops that I was buying for them. And so I had to move, and craziness just kept going. What happened was I went home that Christmas, and Beth just didn't understand how much trouble I was having. And I went over to her house to try to convince her to come and live with me over Christmas break. And I had to move into a new apartment. And Beth's mother didn't insure her on her car. She didn't have car insurance. So she couldn't drive my car because she didn't have insurance. And if she got an accident, I couldn't afford to deal with it because I had a DUI. And doesn't this woman understand? She has to insure her daughter on her car so that she can come live with me because she's going to be a veterinarian. And I'm going to write books and sleep with graduate students and teach classes. And she's ruining my friggin' life. And so I started screaming at this woman in the middle of her living room, her own house, screaming at her that she's ruining my life. None of these people get it. They're all screwing everything up. And Beth just looks at me and said, I can't deal with you anymore. You're out of your friggin' mind. You know, you're just out of your mind. See, I used to go over to Beth's house because it was normal. It was like normal land. They watched fucking Disney movies. Sorry, I swore. I promised myself I wouldn't swear. Now I'm swearing. But they, you know, I'd go over and we'd watch like Dumbo or something like that. And then I'd go out like the other six nights out of the week and I'd get cocked and I'd hang out at bars and I'd flirt with chicks. I couldn't cheat on my girlfriend because only losers cheat on their girlfriends. But I'd just like flirt with. One time a girl walked all the way around the bar, came over, stood right next to me and stuck her tongue down my throat. I told my friend Pat, I'm like, watch, see that girl? I'm going to pick her up. because she didn't believe me that it was easy to pick girls up at the bar, you know. And so she comes walking all the way around the bar, sticks her tongue down my throat. I pushed her away. I was just trying to prove a point. I have a girlfriend. You know, I had absolutely no sense. And then she smacked me, and I didn't get it. Like, why are you smacking me, you know? I'm trying to tell you, I'm a nice guy. I don't cheat on my girlfriend. So, you know, I never really did anything unfaithful, but I used to go and I'd live at bars, and then one night a week I'd have to go over to Beth's house to go watch Dumbo and feel normal. And the whole time I'd be like, I hate it here. And I couldn't wait to get out of there. And finally she freed me. You know, you're done. I mean, this is the girl that... 3.5 years earlier, I met her at my house. I was living on a farm in Sunderland, Massachusetts. I was going to UMass. We used to have raging parties with like 200 people. They get off the bus. They called it the farmhouse. It was my house. And they get off the, which I loved. I mean, I loved it that my house had like a nickname. And it meant I was important, you know. And they'd get off the bus and they'd come to the farmhouse and they'd get drunk and you know, kids would play friggin' sitars out by the fire and like all kinds of weird shit go on. And I moved there with Allison because I was in love with Allison. And she was going to realize she was in love with me. Only she was dating my roommate from my previous house, Jeff, who owed me money, who didn't pay his bills. And she started dating Jeff right after we signed a lease together. Well, what was supposed to happen was Allison was supposed to realize that Jeff was a real jerk. When we moved in together, she was going to fall in love with me, start sleeping with me, and dump Jeff. Well, it didn't happen. And so I had to go find somebody different. So I'm at a party at my house, and this girl shows up, and I don't even like her. But I got to pick somebody up. You know, and now it's 3.5 years later, and I'm going to kill myself over this girl that I never liked. I never liked her the day I picked her up. She was a really nice girl. I took her hostage for 3.5 years so I could make Allison jealous, who I don't even talk to anymore. I don't even know her anymore, you know. And yet, you know, here it is 3.5 years later, and I'm living in Maine, and Beth can't deal with me anymore, so she breaks up with me, and I don't know what to do, so I drink. You know, I keep drinking. And what happened was I spent the next 4 days drunk, which really wasn't any different than the previous, you know, 4 days. But I spent the next 4 days drunk and went to... New Year's Eve night, I went out to Mama Kin's in Boston. And I remember it was midnight, and I looked up. My friend Pat was making out with a chick, and I thought, how dare you? I just broke up with my girlfriend. You're not supposed to be with anybody tonight because you're my buddy and I'm sensitive. And so you're not supposed to, like, I'm the only one allowed to score tonight if anything happens. And I was afraid to talk to anybody. So, you know, so I walked out of Mama Kin's. It was 20 below zero. I was wearing a flannel shirt. And the next thing I knew, I was on the tee. I don't know how I got to the tee. I don't know where I was on the tee. All I knew was that there were four kids. They were, like, of a different ethnic origin, and they were kicking at me, kind of trying to wake me up a little bit. And I remember looking up and just being like, oh, shit, you know, like, where am I? And they stood me up, and they brushed. They were laughing at me, you know, and they were like, kind of, dude, you gotta get together. And so they said, I tried to figure out where I was. I had no idea where I was. They put me back on the train going the other way. They told me where to get off. I called Beth's mother, and Beth's mother was going to fix it. She was going to drive me back to Beth's house, and we were going to make it all different, and everything was going to... Well, Beth's mother was from Al-Anon. So she drove me to Worcester, and we had to go home, and I had to go to my mother's house, and I was humiliated, so I drove back up to Maine, and I spent the next 4 days drunk in Maine. And the last night I drank, I woke up at 10 o'clock in the morning that day, and went down to the Irving station, got my 12-pack, came back, and I started making tapes. I'm going to make tapes. I'm going to start showing chicks in Bangor how cool of a music select. I'm going to make a Miles Davis tape. I'm going to make a tape that has all kinds of, like, bluegrass music on it. And then we're going to have this raging party. No, I don't know anybody. And we're going to make this raging party, and I'm going to play tapes all day long, and everybody's going to see. And I'm making these tapes, and then my time comes, and I go down to the Barb and scoping out, like, Fitzwillie's or something like that. And I go down there. I've never been in it. And I go down there, and I stand at the bar all night long drinking gin and tonic, smoking butts with my new best friend, this kid that I met. And he gave me his lighter. And we were smoking butts and talking and staring at these two girls dancing together all night long. And I'm thinking, I'm going to pick them up. And then I'm thinking, they don't like me. They think I'm gay. Everyone here hates me. And I smoked butts until it was about 1:15, and I realized the Irving station's going to close soon, so I left there. I walked up the street, and I remember standing in front of the refrigerator door at the Irving station, and I said, don't have any friggin' 12-packs. I've been drinking since 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm mad because they don't have any 12-packs. So I grab a 6-pack of Pounders, and I go walk back to my house, and I drank that, and I put my head down, and I said, God, what the is wrong with me? And I picked my head up, and I looked at the beer in my hand, and I just thought, I can't drink anymore. And I don't know. Today, I know where the thought came from. God put that thought in my head. Because I had never, ever in my life, ever wanted to not drink again. Ever. When I was 12 years old, I started drinking, and it took away how I felt. And while it stopped working, it was the only thing I ever knew that took that away. And I never wanted to not drink. So when the thought occurred to me to not drink again, it floored me. I can't drink anymore. So I finished the beer. And but I called Beth on the phone at 2:30 in the morning to inform her of my big awakening. And she didn't disagree. and she also wanted to know why the hell I was calling her at 2:30 in the morning. But I said, what should I do? And I had been to AA when I got my DUI, and her whole family was in AA, and they, you know. So I knew about it, so you should probably call him in the morning. And I did. I called the next morning, and this guy, John, answers the phone. See, the previous 12 years are kind of the same. I could tell you all about them. They're like the same story. It just keeps getting crazier and crazier and crazier until it gets to that day. And then, you know, it's just nuts. And it started off, it was a lot of fun. But it just wasn't fun anymore. I mean, it was a mess. It was absolute insanity. And I didn't know that. Everything I know about what happened, I know now in hindsight. I know as of after writing about it and reading it to my sponsor and then going out and making amends about all this stuff. That's how I understand things to be the way they are today. I mean, what happened was I called AA, and this guy John answered the phone, and he said, hello, this is John. Are you Noel? Actually, he called me back, and I said, yes. He says, I'm from AA. I said, okay, whatever. And he said, I can come pick you up if you want and take you to a meet, and we can get together. I'll be at your house at exactly 9 o'clock. Don't be early, because you'll be wasting your time, and don't be late, or I'll leave. And I like this guy. I like that. He's an ass. And I like people that are like that. So I went out at exactly 9 o'clock, boom, the guy was there. I went over to his house all day long and talked to him about football. I knew nothing about football. He knew nothing about football, but I didn't know that. He just had the football game on, so I assumed I must impress this man with my knowledge of football. So I started telling him everything I know about football. And about, I don't know, probably like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he says, Tom's coming over, okay? So Tom comes over. Tom is from Worcester. Now, I'm living in Bangor, Maine. It's 300 miles from Worcester. Tom used to drink at the bar that I used to stand outside of when I was 14 years old and say, dude, you want to buy me some beer? And you know, we weren't like even close to normal kids either, too, because the guy go like, oh, okay, what do you want, a six-pack? I'd hand him a friggin' stack of ones like this. I need eight cases. And the guy's like, what? And we'd be running across Lincoln Street like this with eight cases of beer, you know? And like five kids would come out of the corners and like, it was insane. We were nuts, you know? And that was 14, 15 years old. And so anyways, Tom knew, I mean, I probably bought dope off of him. He knew the same people I knew. He hung out with the, and it was just like, maybe God put him there, maybe not, I don't know. But it was weird. So that kind of hooked me for the time being, you know, 10 minutes. And then we went to a meeting. And I remember this about the meeting. There was a guy with white hair sitting at the back. And I didn't like him because he was obviously in charge. And he asked if anybody wanted to make a commitment to sobriety. And I said, so 24-hour commitment. I remember standing up to pick up my white chip. I think I had been like informed about the white chip on my way there or something. So I stood up and I started bawling. And I didn't know why I was crying. And that was over 8 years ago. And I know why I was crying. My whole life changed right then. I mean, I had no idea what was going to happen to me over the next 8 years. You know, from the time I was 12 until I was 24 years old, I never didn't drink. I didn't know how to not drink. That day, that minute, I didn't know how to not drink. I still don't know how to not drink. What I learned how to do over the next 8 years is I learned how to do what I'm told. And that's what I do. I do what I'm told. But I didn't do it right away. What I did was I was just going to these meetings. And within like a couple of weeks, I'm looking around the room at these friggin' meetings. And, you know, everybody in the room hates me. You know? And nobody here knows what I know. And I don't really belong here. I mean, I haven't done cocaine. I'm in graduate school. I have 80% of my teeth. There's a whole string of really important reasons why I've never prostituted myself, which is important to me. You know, so therefore I can't possibly belong here. You know, I don't live under a bridge. I didn't drink out of a paper bag. You know, all of the real important reasons for not being an alcoholic were floating around my head all the time. And I remember being at this meeting at Husson College and staring at the back of Katie's head. And Katie, if you ever hear this tape, you know, I'm sorry, but this is what I was thinking about. I was thinking about having sex with Katie. That's it. You know? And like most people who have, like, no sobriety and are sitting around in meetings and haven't done anything to get better, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. I'm sitting in this meeting. I'm staring at the back of Katie's head. I'm thinking about having sex with her. And then I'm looking at all the guys in the room that are three times my size thinking they're going to kick my ass if I even talk to her. Katie probably thinks I'm gay. And so I raised my hand and I started talking about all the things that I understand because I read two chapters out of a Deepak Chopra book. And this guy, Eric, comes over to me after the meeting, and he says, you know, you can do something about the way you feel if you want, and I can help you. And, you know, F you prick, comes to mind like that, you know, like, who do you think you are, you know? But at the same time, what was going on was I was going to these meetings for a month, and I go home, and everybody's saying, oh, it gets better, just keep coming, da-da-da-da-da-da, and, you know, and they're all very nice, and they're trying to help me, and I go home, and I'd stare at the beam in my kitchen and think about hanging myself every night, and I was wondering when it was going to get better. I kept coming, and when's it going to stop? And what was happening was the craziness was just going nonstop in my brain. All the stuff that I just told you about, that was all still going on in my head, only I didn't have the only thing that ever took it away. You know, it wasn't there anymore. It was gone. So it was just going 9,000 miles an hour inside my head, and it wouldn't stop. And I just wanted it to stop. That's all I ever wanted. You know, I wanted that when I was 12. I wanted to understand why the kids acted like they did when I was a kid. I wanted to understand why I had problems. I wanted to understand all these things. I wanted it to go away. I thought understanding it was going to make it go away. And so I went to these meetings, and I kept coming, and I met this guy, Eric, and he offered to help me, and I didn't know what else to do. So like that second when I thought, I need to not drink anymore, for some strange reason I thought, I need to let this kid help me. I didn't know what to do. I was 19 years old, I was going to college, and I couldn't read, and I didn't tell anybody. I never let anybody help me with anything. Letting people help me does not come to me. I don't let that happen. But I didn't know what else to do. I mean, I was really tired of thinking about killing myself. And so I did, and we got together, and we started going over. What do we got? A couple minutes?
Yeah, a couple minutes.
All right. So we started getting together, and we started going over the big book. And he said, you need to understand whether or not you're an alcoholic, because this whole recovery deal is about a relationship with God. And you can't base a relationship with God on a lie. And, you know, this guy never bullshitted me, ever. You know, he just told me straight, boom, this is the way it is. And I like that. And what happened was we got together and we started reading through the description of the alcoholic. We read it all the time in meetings and how it works. I didn't know what the hell it was. The description of the alcoholic is from the doctor's opinion up to page 43 in the big book. That is the description of the alcoholic. At the time when they wrote it, it was the only description of an alcoholic. No one had ever written one before. No one knew what the hell an alcoholic was. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I was sitting around AA meetings, and it come to me and said, I'm Noel, I'm an alcoholic, because he said it, and he's going to say it. But I didn't know what it was, you know. And so we went over it. It's very, 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 very clear. He made it very clear to me. He says, there's two things you need to be concerned with. When you start drinking, can you control the amount of alcohol you drink? I said, no, can't. Can't do it. You know, I have countless examples of, you know, like I start out drinking and I fall out of trees. You know, I end up on 290 hitchhiking home, you know. And he looked at me, he said, good, don't ever drink again. Which is something that's almost kind of taboo to say in AA. But the reality is that's the truth. And he could tell me the truth because he had a solution. See, for somebody to just tell me that would be mean. That's like taunting a guy with no legs saying, come here, you know. But it's not, you know. But he actually had an answer. You could tell a guy with no legs, come here, if you gave him like a wheelchair or a pair of crutches or something. But, you know, he had an answer. He said, you're going to die drunk. Because the reality is, I don't know how to not drink. I can't not drink. There's this other part of alcoholism that I think we don't really like to talk about very much, which is that I have a mental obsession. And the mental obsession occurs when I have no alcohol in my body. It could occur today. It could happen. Just, boom, get this screwed up thought that tells me to go drink. They call it relapse. They have a whole chapter about relapse. It's called More About Alcoholism. Yet we talk about relapse as though it's something that happens other than alcoholism. But relapse is alcoholism. It means that I will drink again. It's like the guarantee. My mind is going to tell me to drink again unless something seriously changes inside of me. And he helped me to understand that. And he says, you know, so what needs to change? He says, well, you need to come to believe that a power greater than yourself restores your sanity. Oh, well, I don't believe that. He says, and then I was terrified. I thought, you know, there's one more thing I can't friggin' do. You know, and he says, well, you're not expected to believe that at this point. You know, 3 weeks ago you were throwing up blood and crap in your pants and pants in Chinese restaurants. No, we don't expect you to come to AA and all of a sudden believe in God. You know, that's not reality. I know some people talk about it as though it's reality, but it's not reality. What's expected is that you've had enough and you're willing to try something different. And that's what step two was to me, was I was willing to try something different. I was willing to do what I was told. And so we got on our knees in his living room and held hands and said the third step prayer. And the whole time I'm worried about whether or not the guy's going to rape me. And I'm thinking about that thing I did when I was a little kid. And, you know, oh, my God, am I going to have to tell him that? And, you know, and that's it. That's all I'm thinking about. And he's having this peaceful experience. And we go home. After we got done, he told me to buy a notebook and a pen before I got there. And we get up from saying the prayer. And he says, now I want you to go home and start writing a list of names of people that piss you off. And I went home and I whipped furniture around the house. I picked a chair up over my head and I threw that across the room and I punched the wall about 15 times and I bawled my eyes out because this guy told me to go do something. You know, I just wanted to go to meetings, you know. But I didn't just want to go to meetings. But I just wanted to go to meetings. But, you know, and it was just... And he said, go home and write a list of names of people that you hate. And I had bought a shirt 2 years earlier that said, every day of my life, I'm forced to add another name to the list of people who piss me off. And I didn't know I'd be actually writing that list out. You know, and there were lots of names. I had somewhere around X names. And it took me somewhere around Y months to write them all down, and they fit in Z notebooks. And that's as specific as I need to get about it. We wrote down all of the people. I wrote down all of the things that I hated about them. There were many. I remember extremely... See, that's one of the things I didn't understand, is I'm not stupid. God gave me this unbelievable mind, and I remember everything. It's awful. I got a guy who's about to start his fifth step. This guy remembers more than I do, and I'm terrified. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I love the people that don't remember. It's like, good, good, you're lucky, man. I mean, I remember what friggin' Danny, who's actually in the program now, threw my teeny, meeny, miny mo's at the school steps at Thorndike Road School when we were 4 years old at the Memorial Day celebration with my brother and his sister. They were in school singing around the flagpole. We were playing with my brand new friggin' teeny meeny miny mo's, and Danny whipped him at the friggin' school steps. And he didn't care. Both of us are in AA now. So, you know, I mean, all the way from that to... My dad wanted to play with somebody else's kids and left me at home when I had just had brain surgery 3 months earlier so he could go play baseball with somebody else's kids who were better than me. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. It sucks. But he didn't know how to be any other way. And so we look at all these things, we look at what they affect in our lives, and we look at our part, you know, we look at what we wanted out of things, and we turn things around and we look at them from a different perspective so we can have forgiveness for people. Because if we don't have forgiveness for people, we don't have any business asking people for forgiveness. And that's what I come to understand. You know, and I spent some time reading that to my sponsor, this guy, Brian. Eric had moved, and Brian picked up as my sponsor, and I'd moved to Massachusetts now, and Brian lived in Camden, Maine. I lived in Worcester now, or Millbury, Mass., and I didn't trust anybody else in the world. You know, I was a couple years sober at this point, and Brian was the person I trusted, period. That was it. And that's okay. And I tell that to the guys I spoke, you know. So many times people, like, what I realized through my writing was that there were so many people that I made myself vulnerable to that I had no business ever trusting. You know, and I lied to myself about what I trusted people with. You know, girlfriends, kids I did drugs with, kids I drank with. You know, and then I wonder why they did things like pick up my girlfriend and start having sex with them. Or like, you know, all kinds of things that happened, and I wondered why they happened. But like, I put myself in the position to get hurt. You know, I just wanted people to like me. I wanted everyone to like me. Everyone. The whole world. Everybody in the planet is supposed to like me. And so I do things because of that fear. So anyways, this guy Brian's the first guy in the world I've ever trusted. So I'll damn right I'm going to friggin' read my inventory to him. So I drove 3.5 hours up to Camden, Maine to read my inventory to him. And I did that a couple of times. And he called me up one day and he drove 3.5 hours down to Massachusetts to listen to me read inventory. I sat on my couch for 7 hours and just listened. And then he took me out to dinner and bought me a big steak. And he drove back up to Maine because he had a prison commitment. This is a bank felon. This is a guy who robbed banks, who's a crack addict and a drunk. Why would he do that? You know? And I learned something about what it means to sponsor people by my fifth step, you know? Brian understood that if I didn't do this, I was going to hang myself from the beam in the kitchen, you know? If something didn't fundamentally change inside of me, I was not going to be alive much longer. And so we did it, you know? And I went out and I started making amends. I made amends, and those were a blessing. Next weekend, I get to put in a hardwood floor with my father, you know, the guy who wanted nothing to do with me. The guy who actually just didn't know how to want something to, you know, he didn't know how to do something with me is really all it was. And, you know, it's just a miracle. Last night I didn't stay because my wife was at home. And she's my wife. I didn't understand that. Beth was going to have my kids and work and take care of my stuff while I drank, you know. Last year, my wife got sick, and I was working two jobs to make sure that things got done. And then my brother-in-law got cancer, and I didn't know what to do, so I have a 10th step that I write out every morning. And I mean, you want to feel powerless. You have a guy who weighs 300-and-something pounds get cancer and start having a tumor grow off the side of his face. He's got two kids at home. And what the hell did he do, you know? And I don't know what to do. So I'm writing inventory, and I said, you could paint the house. So I started driving up to Maine to paint the house. Because now things are much clearer today. I don't have the craziness, the chaos running around in my head. What the hell do I need to do, you know, blah, 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 blah. Just constant madness in my mind, you know? And so I drove up, and I painted the house while I was working, and you know, he died. I didn't drink. A year ago yesterday, I got out of the hospital. I had brain surgery. It was a year from hell. I have hydrocephalus. I have a shunt in my brain. It had found its way. It goes down into my gut. It's a plastic tube. And it stuck me in the liver. And it was sticking me in the liver for about 6 months. And I couldn't find a doctor that understood what the hell was wrong with me. They wouldn't even look. And I was doing my 10th step one night, and I wrote it out. Why don't I go to another doctor? You know, I was on this insurance plan that I thought I was stuck in New Hampshire, and I was afraid. That's what it came down to. I was afraid to go to another doctor. I was afraid. And so I went to a meeting down in Boston, and a friend of mine, I was reading the inventory to him, and I happened to know that he was a neuropsychologist because a year earlier I was reading my inventory to him and he started telling me about what it's like to have hydrocephalus. And I'm like, what the hell? How do you know this? And he's a neuropsychologist. It's like what he does for a living. And he got me all this help to get so that I had all my medical records and all this other shit. So anyways, I ended up having brain surgery a year ago yesterday. because all of this stuff happened from my 10th step that allowed me to have the information I needed to go and give the information down to the doctor down in Boston. If I didn't do a 10th step, if I didn't write things out and deal with it, I would have never known any of that. I wouldn't have known it. I would have just hated the doctor in New Hampshire. And I wouldn't have another solution. He's a prick. And I'm dead, you know. And so what I have instead is I have this process that allows me to get down to the truth so that I actually know what to pray about. You know, I used to pray for, you know, God bless this asshole and that jerk and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. That's nice and it's a good start, but, you know, it's a lot more effective to be able to say, God help me because I'm afraid of failing tomorrow at work when I have to give a presentation. That's really what I'm afraid of. I have to give a presentation. I know that I have to do it tomorrow. I mean, this is the truth. This is what's going on tomorrow. I wrote it out in my notebook today. I'm afraid. I've never failed at anything in my life. And yet I'm afraid that I'm going to fail. God's not going to let me fail. You know, won't happen. So, you know, these are the things that happen. And because of that, I get to carry this message to other people, you know. And it's really remarkable to be able to watch other people go through what I was taught how to do. And that's really the whole gift of a Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I came here and it was all about me. And today, it ain't all about me, you know. And hopefully I've been able to say something to somebody that, you know, meant something. And if not, just ignore everything I said because it might kill you. It might have been my opinion. My opinions aren't very good. I really am honored to be here, and thanks a lot for asking me to speak. And thanks for getting up on Sunday morning when you were probably up till Sunday morning. So, thank you.